Well, it's been amazing what's been happening in the state of Israel, and all of you have been watching that on the news, and we talked about it the last time. I think I spoke about the Iron Dome that protects Israel from bombs from the Gaza Strip, which is governed by a radical Islamic group called Hamas. And I kind of choke on the word radical Islamist group because the Bible prophecy shows that in the end is all of Islam is going to be radicalized. And even though there are some Muslims today, even living in this country, who would probably be considered moderate in that sense, it's probably because they're not fervent adherents to their religion, because undoubtedly Muslim in its purest form or the work of Islam is certainly radical in its nature, and it's bent on the destruction of the West, and we know that from, well, even from the Charter of Hamas and from everything that they write, and you'll see some of that today. But we'll begin today with a rather obscure passage and a rather obscure prophecy, as a matter of fact, that the Bible is a book about Israel, and it's about the nations that come into contact with Israel, and there's not a lot of detail of other nations such as Japan and China and maybe a lot of African nations and so on, at least the Southern African and Western Eastern African nations. So the Bible is a book that details the biblical history of the nation of Israel, but here's a prophecy that is often overlooked in the book of Genesis about one of the descendants of Abraham, and that's Ishmael, and he was the offspring of Hagar. And God actually says, as you can read it for yourself, that he would become, his descendants would become a great nation. And that has come to pass. That prophecy has come to pass. And this prophecy was also repeated in Genesis 21, verses 13 through 21, as you can see. Sarah did not want to have Hagar, the handmaiden, around any longer, and so she asked Abraham to cast her out. And it was not a circumstance in which really was favorable for her or for her son, Ishmael. They're cast basically out into the desert, as you can see, and God intervened and saved the life of both Hagar and the son, and so preserved at least, you know, the enmity that would exist between the descendants of Abraham, and then a little bit further on down, we see the further descendants of Abraham and his progeny and Isaac and Jacob and so on and so forth. And so the Bible is a book that shows that these groups of people are going to come into conflict during the time of the end. And so it's a worthwhile prophecy to note, as, you know, certainly as important to end time prophecy as Genesis 49 and Genesis 48 and so on. I think we covered the last time. So, here is just a list of some of the Middle Eastern and Islamic nations. All of them would be 90% or above in terms of their religious affinity to the nation of Islam, or the, not the nation of Islam, that's an American creation, but to Islam, the religion founded in the 6th century AD by Muhammad, who, by the way, was a descendant of Ishmael, and all of those peoples in that particular area where, you know, Iraq is now, where they came from, and Arabia, where they originated from, all of those individuals were polytheistic in nature. They had 365 gods to correspond with the days of the year. So in their temples, they worshipped a different god every day. And so Muhammad came along in his 20s or 30s, and he united people by getting them to follow just one of those gods. And that's the mistake that a lot of people make in terms of viewing Christianity and Islam, because some Christians ignorantly say, well, the God that they worship, and even some Muslims may even believe this, Allah is the God of the Old Testament, or Allah is the same God that Christians worship, the one God. Not really. Muhammad had a genius in being able to eliminate factions among the peoples, among his peoples, and to unite them, or try to unite them, by the worship of just one God, and that was the moon god. And Allah is the moon god, and the symbol of Islam is the crescent moon. So that's where his genius lie, and it's undeniable that throughout history, throughout the 600s and the 700s, the people of Islam were better at understanding history and science and mathematics. And I'm not, you know, just, you, it's a historical fact. And it wasn't until the spread of Islam into southern Europe to where they were able to bring to Europe itself the original Greek writings and Greek texts and some of the great thinking of Greece and Rome that the Renaissance, as the Europeans call it, or the Renaissance as we call it, actually happened, because they rediscovered a lot of lost information and began to apply it in the Middle Ages, and the Dark Middle Ages began to be more enlightened at that time. Of course, not all knowledge is as good as we know, but this gives you a general outline of all of these nations, their population. The only one that is not from the Middle East is Indonesia, and that is the most populous of all Muslim nations, over 300 million, which may, as we'll see a little bit later towards the end of the message today, may have a part in Bible prophecy at the time of the end. So some things are a little bit indistinct. We're given kind of a rough outline, and the Bible doesn't go any further, as you'll see. This just gives a general map of the Middle East, and it's so big, and it's such a huge area, and this includes all of those nations that were up on the screen before with all their various populations, and we have to move over a little bit further. I don't even put in Indonesia, but we can see that all of these nations have been in the news, Libya and Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Turkey up here, and Iraq and Iran right next to one another, very important. But all of these nations have been touched by Islam and all around this whole core. And the only one, of course, that is democratic and is the state of Israel, which is the smallest of all of them, has the smallest population, which is really interesting. The combined population of all of these is around 500 million, and the population of Israel, just surrounded by all of these Islamic states, many of them now becoming overtaken with radicalism. I won't even say radical Islam, because in its purest form, it is a radical religion. It's either you're a believer or you're an infidel. And anybody that is not of the Islamic faith, as you've seen in the news recently, many of these 40,000 people that are on a mountaintop 4,000 feet above sea level in northwestern Iraq who have been driven there, and if we do not intervene as a country, are going to be slaughtered, which I think is a forerunner of Bible prophecy at the time of the end as to what is going to happen to the people of Jacob that is mentioned in several Bible prophecies, the most prominent of them being Isaiah 63 and the book of Obadiah. And if you want to read the book of Obadiah, which we won't today, you'll see a detailed analysis of what Christ is going to do as soon as he returns to this earth. And the first thing he's going to do is to annihilate and virtually destroy every single one, apparently, of these individuals that are mentioned in Obadiah. Now, we used to think that the book of Obadiah was a prophecy specifically to Turkey. The Turks, after all, had been the Ottoman Empire, which had dominated the Middle East, the entire Middle East, for hundreds and hundreds of years. And Turkey was the one nation that had kind of remained intact after the Middle East was kind of split up after World Wars I and World Wars II. The French and the British began to take more control and more domination of that area, which was prominently figured into Bible prophecy as well. But 500 million people approximately in that area right around the Middle East, as opposed to 7 million in Israel. There are 57 Islamic nations, 22 comprised mostly of Arabic descent. And those 22 nations of Arabic descent are nations which control much of the world's oil. Most of the oil. And interestingly, as you probably, well, I think we mentioned it last time in the last sermon, Israel itself has now discovered in the Mediterranean Sea, right offshore of Israel, vast natural gas reserves and oil. So the one thing that the only thing that they haven't had that all the other Arab nations have had for years is oil. And now they're beginning to exploit their own energy, which could be a tremendous boon economically for that country, which is the best economy of that entire region, because all the rest are either governed by dictatorships or monarchies, and they suck up all the money, and the populace, many of the populace remain poor. The Saudi family is one of the wealthiest in the world, and the general citizenry of Saudi Arabia is pretty wealthy as well, because they have been a little bit more magnanimous in sharing some of that wealth. But many of the rest of them remain poverty-stricken, especially in the Gaza Strip, which you've seen recently. And then, providentially, Israel was able to discover these tunnels that you've heard about that were dug deep down under in the Gaza Strip and emerge in areas. And the plan, if executed, would have been horrific. It would have been far worse than the consequences of 9/11 in our country, because they were poised to send their freedom fighters into Israel at locations like elementary schools and churches and various places where they would just kill thousands upon thousands of innocent civilians. So it's something that we're far removed from, thankfully, in terms of distance, but I know that you pay attention to these things on a day-by-day basis, and it's rather chilling. And getting back to what's happening in Iraq after we left, these militants whom you've heard about, radical militants who are trying to form an Islamic State. We've heard the name ISIS. It's the Islamic State of Syria and Iraq. That's what it stands for. These individuals have gone into areas where we had basically cleaned out the militants in previous two wars, the previous war, Gulf War, and they have taken it over in the vacuum of American leadership. Now, you know, it's a crazy world. What do you do in a situation? Our president is now reluctantly going to send in some help for these people, but getting back to the book of Obadiah, I know I'm kind of dancing around the whole issue, but I guess that's what happens when you don't have any notes. But the people of Obadiah, or the descendants of what we used to think would be just solely the Turks, but Jacob's brother, help me out here. Anyway, those individuals, I think, comprise an incredible group, not just because there will be this attitude that we can see happening, this attitude of jealousy and antipathy towards Israel, towards the United States, and towards Great Britain. We can see that happening on a day-by-day basis. A couple of reasons for that. Our wealth and jealousy over the wealth, and that goes back to Esau, the descendants of Esau, that's who I was thinking of. That goes back to Esau's jealousy over his brother stealing the birthright, and it's continued on to this day. And also because all around the world we've exported the decadent aspects of our culture, all the things that, as bad as some of these Middle Eastern countries and regimes can be, sometimes the family is very important to them, and they can see that all of this, which is being exported by satellite into their homes and televisions, which they watch, I guess, but they decry us for having these low standards. And so a couple of different reasons. But you remember the last time I spoke, I talked about Hosea 5, in which it said that Hosea 5 details the time in which Israel and Judah and Ephraim will all fall together, all within a period of a full moon or a new moon, and about 30 days. So the demise, when it happens, is going to be very abrupt. And I don't look for it in the next year or two, but, you know, all bets are off in terms of assigning dates. But these Christians and others who refuse to bow to ISIS are isolated now, 40,000 strong. And you probably saw the news report of the woman in Iraq who said, "Who is going to save these people?" And traditionally, the United States has been the world's policeman, but you can see the decline in our power and prestige and the vacuum that has been being created and the stage being set for all kinds of prophecies to come to pass. This just gives another snapshot of that concentrated area of Israel and how small it is, and about the size of the state of New Jersey with 7 million people. So this is a very interesting prophecy, and If you remember nothing else in the sermon today, remember Psalm 83. Do not keep silent, O God. Do not hold your peace, and do not be still, O God, for behold, your enemies make a tumult, and those who hate you have lifted up their head, and they have taken crafty counsel against your people and have consulted together against your sheltered ones. They have said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be remembered no more. That has a dual application, I believe, in terms of the modern identity of the peoples of Israel, as well as the modern nation of Israel, or we would say Judah, today. And it is everywhere in the Arab world. It is the goal, and it is the preoccupation, it is the obsession of all of Islam to make sure that Israel is destroyed. This is one of the goals of Islam. This is from one of the Muslim Brotherhood spokesperson. Every night when I go to bed, I pray to wake up the next day to see Israel is wiped off the map. That is one of the goals of Islam. And if the Islamic world is not united in anything, and there may be some other areas of Islam and other parts of what used to be called the Soviet Union, the southern part of Soviet Union, where that may not be the goal, but specifically in the Middle East, that is definitely a goal and has been since the inception of the State of Israel in 1948. The other goal of Islam, and we don't see this on the horizon, is the unity of all of the Islamic faith into a state, or it doesn't appear that that will ever happen, into one state. Bible prophecy seems to indicate that they will all remain a confederacy of nations, but they will grow closer and closer. There are, as you are aware, there are factions and divisions that have separated the Islamic faith and the people, and who are the appropriate garters of the faith is a question that has been unresolved since the death of Muhammad in, I believe, 632 A.D., Double check that date. You don't want to put it down in your notes, but just from memory. The unity that is being sought by ISIS in Syria and Iraq is a caliphate or a leader who will unite all of these peoples and their factions. And they are divided and they have warred against one another since the time of the death of Muhammad. Every successor that would be chosen for the first five or six successors of Muhammad were actually murdered by one of the other factions, which we know as the Sunnis and the Shiites, and they developed very early. There's a great deal of controversy still in the Islamic world as to who are the rightful descendants of Muhammad, and one of their goals eventually will be to come to this point, and it appears from Bible prophecy that they will attain that goal at some point. There are two types of territory in the earth, the Dar al-Islam, or the land of Islam, where there are believers, and the areas that you live in, where you're considered an unbeliever or an infidel. And that's where the prophecy of Psalm 83 comes to pass even more. And so we see these confederacies of groups of people, all of them Islam, and we know who these descendants are today. This is the continuation of Psalm 83. I have to get up here a little bit because I can't read it. And since we're taping this, I should read this. Verse 5, for they have consulted together with one consent. They formed a confederacy against you, the tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites, Moab and the Hagarites, Gabel, Ammon, and Amalek, Philistia with the inhabitants of Tyre. Assyria is also joined with them. They have also helped the children of Lot. Deal with them as with Midian, as with Sisera, as with Jabin at the brook Kishon, who perished at Endor, who became his refuse on the earth. Make their nobles like Oreb and Zeb, yes, all their princes like Zeba and Zalmunna, who said, let us take for ourselves the pastures of God for a possession. That is one of the goals, even though it's not written in anything, I suppose you could find that's one of the goals of Islam, certainly. Oh my God, make them like the whirling dust, like the chaff before the wind, as the fire burns the woods and as the flame sets the mountains on fire. So pursue them with your tempest and frighten them with your storm, fill their faces with shame that they may seek your name, O Lord. Let them be confounded and dismayed forever. Yes, let them be put to shame and perish that they may know you, whose name alone is the Lord, are the Most High over all the earth. And eventually, the good news is, that's going to happen after Christ returns. Now, here is the all of these individuals that are mentioned in Psalm 83. This is where they come from. So they're not all descendants in the Middle East from Ishmael or from Hagar. Some of them come from Edom or from Esau, Jacob's brother, which I, for some reason, couldn't remember. And here's where they are today. Turks, Palestinians, maybe some in Europe, Moab, Palestinians, other Arab nations. They were just to the east of Jerusalem, the Moabites, as you know, Hagarites, Gabel, southern Jordan, perhaps. A lot of these are maybe indistinct. Ammon, Palestinians in Jordan, Amalek, central Turkey, Turkish Asians, maybe some other countries, Philistines, the Gaza Strip, a little narrow strip just south of Israel, Tyre, perhaps Lebanon, and Assyria, maybe northern Iraq, because that's where Assyria was, anciently speaking. Now, if you will do a search on the various terrorist groups around the globe, you'll find dozens and dozens and dozens, all the way from Ireland, northern Ireland. They've had their terrorism. That has quieted down in the last 20 years. Certainly was a huge issue back when I was in England in the 70s. But here are the main distinct divisions of Islamic terrorists that we've heard about. Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Hezbollah, ISIS, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Taliban. Al-Qaeda was formed by Osama bin Laden, as you know. And that's the reason we went to war in 2002. The Hamas are the political group and party and terrorist group that governs the Gaza Strip. And as one of the articles that one of you sent me mentions, with all this vast array of tunnels that they have dug, I think there was like 13 that they found. Is that correct? About 13 or so that they found. Very elaborately built. Very sophisticated, cost millions and millions and millions of dollars, while the Palestinians, whom they govern, are in poverty. They had this desire and this plan to inflict this damage upon Israel, not only from above ground with the missiles they're sending in every day, 4,500, I think, in the last year or so, to going underneath and digging underneath the state of Israel to pop up in the middle of nowhere with their bands of fighters and kill innocent civilians. Hezbollah, or the Party of Allah, is the group that was begun in the 1980s, funded by Iran, in the nation of Lebanon, and they have been there ever since. ISIS has been active in Syria and in Iraq, notable for either forcing non-believers or Christians to recant, to convert, or face being beheaded or shot. And many thousands have already been killed because of that. I believe that's a precursor to what's going to happen in, as it says in Obadiah, that they're going to do the same thing to the sons of Jacob at that time. And if you can think about 40,000 people being potentially annihilated unless the United States intervenes, then, you know, I know that if some of you were president, you would send a photograph of the highway from Kuwait to Baghdad after the first Gulf War. Do you remember that very famous picture? They called it the Highway to Hell, after these fleeing Iraqi soldiers were trying to move out of, after we had retaken Kuwait. A high school friend of mine was a part of that expeditionary force in the Marines that actually went in there and took Kuwait back from the Iraqis. But they stole everything they could lay their hands on, TVs and dishwashers and everything. And as they were trying to make their way back to Baghdad, our fighters, you know, just blitzed them. Nobody survived that attack. Not one person survived out of that. There were thousands of Iraqi soldiers who were you know, they'd stolen cars and TV sets and everything that wasn't nailed down, but they were all destroyed. But if I were president and you were president, you'd probably send that to the leaders of ISIS and say, this is what's going to, you know, you wouldn't say a warning, you know, get out. You would just make it happen. But the Muslim Brotherhood is actually has its roots in Iran, or pardon me, not Iran, in Saudi Arabia. And in fact, it is the schools of Saudi Arabia that are famous for teaching the radical terrorism and the attitude towards the West. And then, of course, the Taliban, which were active in Afghanistan and still are active in Afghanistan. Osama bin Laden founded al-Qaeda in Pakistan. They began, and this is the twist of history that is ironic in a sense, it all began with their opposition to the Soviets invading Afghanistan in the 1980s, or the 1970s. And for a number of years, the United States covertly funded to the tune of billions and billions of dollars in aid and war, and, you know, a very famous congressman from East Texas who was on the Appropriations Committee at that time was able to secretly obscure all this. His name was Charlie Wilson. He was able to get this funding, and he was able to broker deals with Egypt and Israel together, working in concert with one another and the United States, and sending munitions to these freedom fighters, which eventually led to the Soviets departing Afghanistan, because the thing that really ruled that territory were these huge Russian helicopter gunships. And when they got the surface-to-air missiles that came from the United States to knock them down, then the tide of the battle was turned. And so it was a very interesting story. But now those same munitions were turned on our soldiers by the same freedom fighters when we went in. Hamas is, as I mentioned, the group that governs the area of the Gaza Strip. The Palestinians are Sunnis, which is the largest of the two major groups of Islam, and they're an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is very radicalized, as you know, and it's the one that tried to take over Egypt for a while. But Egypt is, even though it's an Islamic nation, is a very secular nation, and they did not want to have a government that was ruled by Sharia law, by Muslim law. So they got booted out, despite our best intent to allow the Muslim Brotherhood to remain there. And it was just, politics is crazy. So the Sunni Muslims make up 90%. Here are some of their beliefs. Predeterminism. They believe in governing by consensus through elections. So they're not democratic by any means, but more so than the Shiite Muslims. They believe that the son-in-law of Muhammad, or Ali, was the rightful successor. The greatest concentration, the greatest percentage of Shiite Muslims are in Iran. And they believe that the rightful successor, a caliphate, will appear at the end of the world. And that's what their prophecy, they believe in prophecy. They believe in their five supports: unity, prophecy, resurrection, imamate, and justice. And imamate is the universal authority for all secular and religious affairs. This is the most radical of all of the groups, and these are the ones that are the fiercest and the most most radicalized of all the various sects of Islam. I mentioned this earlier. They're responsible in Saudi Arabia for setting the tone and education of radical Islam, and they have these adherents of al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood. But you've heard these terms, and if you're like me, wow, how do you keep all this straight? So you just got to go look them up one by one and see, okay, who are they, what do they mean, where are they from, where do they dominate? My opinion, and it's just an opinion, is that all of these peoples are going to be united under a common cause in the future, and that common cause is going to be against Israel. They are the people of the Sabbath, whose young people God turned into apes, whose old people God turned into swine to punish them, as cited in Ibn Abbas. The apes are Jews, the keepers of the Sabbath, while the swine are the Christian infidels of the communion of Jesus. That is what is taught in the schools, and if you have generation after generation of that thought process and teaching, then it's going to have an effect, and that's what people are going to believe. And this is just a slide that shows the West Bank. Here's the Gaza Strip down here. This is where many of the Palestinians are concentrated. And I thought a very interesting series this past week has been on the Fox News Channel with Sean Hannity. I don't know if any of you caught that, in Jerusalem and having great interviews there. But again, it shows the small size comparatively. Okay, now, Israel. When I say Israel here, I mean the nation of Israel today, that size, that postage stamp size country known as Israel today. How did it come to be? 1917, in the British Parliament, the British, after World War I, or at the end of, nearing the end of World War I, the Balfour Declaration basically declared a national homeland for the Jews. And that declaration that established that was done by the British, who basically could do whatever they wanted, so because they controlled the world at that time, and they would become victorious along with the United States in World War I. And so it was set up, it was ready to go, it was ready to be enacted, but it never did happen for many, many years. And in 1948, enough Jews had emigrated to Israel that state was, they declared themselves a state. In fact, they kicked the British out at that time, and the British got tired of messing with these pesky Jews and the problems that were happening in all of the Middle East, because they had conquered the Ottoman Turks in World War I as a part of World War I, and they had won control over that whole area and still had control. But by 1947-48, Britain was giving Pakistan and India their independence, and they just got tired of it. And we know that that is a fulfillment of Bible prophecy, because they lost some various areas all around the world. But they just, after they bombed the Hotel of David, I believe that's the name of it, in 1948, and killed about 100 British servicemen, then they called it quits and left. And then it was, since the British were no longer there controlling, dominating, then the Israelis set up their own independent state. In 1956, the Suez Crisis was over the Panama Canal, which was financed by America and specifically Britain and France. And they threatened to close that canal to shipping, and the British and the French intervened, along with the Israelis, who invaded the Negev Desert and basically, you know, overtook that territory, which the British and the Americans forced them to give back at one time. But that particular battle, the Israelis were a part of as well. And in every significant war that has happened, and I think as a fulfillment partially of Bible prophecy, even at 1948, immediately when Israel declared its independence and declared an independent state, they were attacked by the five nations that surrounded them, Lebanon and Syria and Jordan and Egypt, and they repelled that attack, and they were able to beat all of those, as they did in the Six-Day War in 1967, and they won back significant territory from Jordan at that particular time. And the argument since that time has been whether we should go back to these borders that were there in force before 1967. And that has been the issue, you know, will there be a division of two, will there be a Palestinian state established in that area? Well, both parties have been promised different things throughout history, and it's all gotten very, very confused. But that is what was even proposed a couple of years ago by President Obama, that those borders should go back to that what it was before 1967, when they won that land, or the West Bank, as it's called. So Israel won that war. They won the 1973 Yom Kippur War. And the intelligence reports that Israel has had is that these tunnels were going to be used in concert with more and more rockets to launch an invasion of Israel on one of their holy days in the fall, which apparently that for now has been thwarted. I believe that all of these are at least show a partial fulfillment of Bible prophecy already, and it's this one in Zechariah 12. Beginning in verse 1, the burden of the Lord against Israel. Thus says the Lord, who stretches out the heavens, lays the foundation of the earth, and forms the spirit of man within him. Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of drunkenness to all the surrounding peoples, when they lay siege against Judah and Jerusalem. And it shall happen in that day that I will make Jerusalem a very heavy stone for all peoples. All who would heave it away will surely be cut in pieces, though all nations of the earth are gathered against it. I find it interesting that in every war, Israel has prevailed, even though they are much smaller than all the nations that have gone against them. It's obvious that they have atomic weaponry, and very few of the other nations surrounding them do. None of them do. The closest one would be Pakistan. But now Iran is building centrifuges in order to try to create their own nuclear capability. I think Israel has shown great restraint in not bombing the heck out of Iran and taking out those potential nuclear facilities, which they did back in the 80s. And so, but I believe that all of those battles so far have been a partial fulfillment, because all of these nations want to go against Israel, but they have not been able to so far. Now, I think in the future, it's going to be even more significant as all nations around the earth surround Jerusalem. We know that that's going to happen. Matthew 24 shows that Jerusalem is going to be surrounded. Other prophecies show that it's going to be surrounded. So, in that day, which specifically refers to the time of the end, verse 4, I will strike every horse with confusion and its rider with madness, and I will open my eyes on the house of Judah and will strike every horse of the peoples with blindness. Now, Daniel 11, a really interesting prophecy beginning in verse 40, as you all know, you're well familiar with this. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, and many ships. And he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. He shall also enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. The Bible says that these three nations, Edom, Moab, and Ammon, set on their lees in another prophecy, I believe it's Ezekiel. That means they have basically stayed in the areas in which they occupied anciently. And those would be the nations basically Jordan and south of Jordan. That's where those people still are today. And for some reason, some have theorized that if God's people are taken to a place of safety, and one of those places of safety that has been mentioned in the Bible or potentially is the area of Jordan, where else? What else? What's south of Jordan? Petra, yeah. So that is the theory. If you're looking forward to going to Petra, then you're a better person than I am. There's nothing there except rocks and a carved-out temple and a winding road, and more famous now for its spot in a few films, Raiders of the Lost Ark and so on. So, but they are going to escape out of his hand. Maybe they'll make a treaty. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. Now, who is or who will be the king of the South? Could it be a last caliph or religious leader? Could it be a head of state? Could it be a monarch that is presently alive? Could it be somebody that will become a political leader on the order of a Saddam Hussein or an Ayatollah Khomeini or somebody of that nature? The answer is we don't know, because the Bible leaves the King of the South there and doesn't really mention who that individual will come from. So all we're left with is our own speculation. I offer those up as potential things, but we don't know. But it is obvious that the King of the South, whoever he may be, or she, well, I guess he wouldn't be a king then, would he? But whoever the King of the South is, will apparently unite the Islamic faith and world, even though they may be a confederacy of nations, and push against the, I like the King James rather than the New King James in this section, he will push at them. Does that mean that Europe will be the site of attacks in the future? Because they've certainly had their share of immigration, and they've certainly done their best immigration from the Islamic world. They've certainly had their share of problems posed by that, and they've had the opportunity to recruit many people to the radicalized form of Islam. So could it be terrorist attacks in Europe? It's a possibility. And we just don't know what that will be, whether it'll be a military attack or something, but it is going to enrage the King of the North. And we're pretty sure that the King of the North is going to be the resurrected Holy Roman Empire mentioned in Revelation 13. In Daniel 11 and verse 44, it says, "But news from the east and the north shall trouble him, and therefore he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many." This is referring to the King of the North. News will from the east and from the north. Now, who will this be? And I will offer two possibilities, in which in the past I would only offer one possibility, a combination of Russia and China, which could be one of the answers. Certainly could be, but we have to figure in some other prophecies to maybe come up with some other ideas. In Revelation 9 and verse 13 through 16, "Then the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar, which is before God, saying to the sixth angel who had the trumpet, 'Release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates.'" The Euphrates River runs from Turkey all the way down into Iraq, and that it empties into the Gulf of Aqaba, I believe. Does that mean that these individuals, so the four angels who had been prepared for the hour and a day and a month and a year, were released to kill a third of mankind? Now the number of the army of the horsemen was 200 million. I heard the number of them. Could that come from the King of the South, or the combined forces of the Islamic world, which now number 1.3 billion. In the past, I can just tell you that we would always refer to this as a force probably only to be put together by the nations of Gog and Magog in Bible prophecy, or Russia and China. But the possibility does remain that it could be a unified state under a last caliph or a religious leader or the King of the South, or maybe that is the one and the same. So those are two possibilities. It could be Russia, China, and the Islamic hordes as well. It could mean all of them. But we don't know, and we probably are not going to know until further into the future. But I throw that out to you as two distinct possibilities. Revelation 16 and verse 14 tells us something very important that figures in prominently into world events, and that we cannot really deduce things always by the natural, logical order of things that govern peoples. Who was it, the famous economist that Adam Smith, who basically postulated that people are motivated by their self-interest, and while that is true in history, there's going to be another motivating force at the time of the end. And that is going to be the devil. He's going to motivate European unity. He's also going to motivate all of mankind. For they are the spirits of demons performing signs which go out to the kings of the earth and the whole world to gather them to the battle of that great day of God Almighty. It's horrific to contemplate all of these prophecies and the things that happen as time goes on. So we don't know exactly what will bring all of this together. I've listed a few of them. The United States no longer relies on the majority of its oil from the Middle East. That was back in the 70s. That was in the days before some of you were even born, when we were in long lines on odd days or even days, depending on what your license plate ended up with, waiting for our ration of gas. Those days are no longer there. We produce, we're the world's largest oil producer now, and we would be even producing more if we had a government that would allow the exploration on federally owned lands where there's an abundance of energy. We've got more natural gas than any other nation on the face of the earth. We have the potential for other forms of energy like nuclear and solar power and wind power. I mean, there's one thing that is not going to bring this country down. It's going to be the supply of energy, which in the 70s we could never have imagined, because we were running out of oil. Now we've got more oil than we ever have had, and we're the world's largest producer. But if the supply of oil was cut off to the rest of the world, to Europe on a cold winter, going through the Suez Canal or going up through the pipelines that go through the Middle East and empty into the Gulf of Hormuz and wherever, who knows if that could be a potential instigator of world events. Could Jerusalem be defended once again as it was anciently, over a thousand years ago, by crusaders who come down to defend? Maybe that's one of the reasons that the king of the south or the king of the north comes against to surround Jerusalem, because of the threats toward Christianity. Daniel 11 and verse 45, it says, "And he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him." That refers to the king of the north, as you know. Mark 13 and verse 14, by the earlier prophecies about Israel being a stone that would be heavy for any nation to move, you might think, well, you know, maybe the safest place of all might be to live in Israel then. But not really. So when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing where it ought not, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. I mentioned the prophecy of Obadiah. A companion prophecy is the first few verses of Isaiah 63 that show what Christ is going to do to the enemies of Jacob during the time of the end. It is going to be a bloodbath. It is going to be a spectacular annihilation, if you can call it that, of all of these people who have opposed Israel. That's the first order of business, and it's a very poetic piece in Isaiah 63, which says, who is this who comes from Basra? You know, his robes dipped in blood. And the answer comes from Christ himself. You know, he alone has the arm strong enough to defeat these enemies. Let's see if I've inserted this scripture. Okay. What did I do with my Bible? I forgot to take it up with me is what I did. Revelation 19. And beginning in verse 11. "Now I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he judges and makes war. His eyes were like a flame of fire, and on his head were many crowns. He had a name written that no one knew except himself. He was clothed with a robe dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. And the armies in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, followed him on white horses. Now out of his mouth goes a sharp sword, that with it he should strike the nations, and he himself will rule them with a rod of iron. He himself treads the winepress of the fierceness and wrath of Almighty God. And he has on his robe and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Then I saw an angel standing on the sun, and he cried with a loud voice, saying to all the birds that fly in the midst of heaven, come and gather together for the supper of the great God, that you may eat the flesh of kings, the flesh of captains, the flesh of the mighty men, the flesh of horses, and of those who sit on them, and the flesh of all people, free and slave, both small and great. And I saw the beast, the kings of the earth, and their armies gathered together to make war against him who sat on the horse and against his army. So, obviously, Christ returns and is opposed by all those nations that have gathered now around the Holy Land, around Israel. It's going to be a spectacular sight. Now, I did not put the specific chapter here. Let's see who can figure it out, and a prize at the end. The governor of Judah shall say in their heart, the inhabitants of Jerusalem are my strength, in the Lord of hosts their God. In that day I will make the governors of Judah like a fire pan in the woodpile, and like a fiery torch in the sheaves, and they shall devour all the surrounding peoples on the right hand and on the left. But Jerusalem shall be inhabited again after her own place, Jerusalem. The Lord gave the tents of Judah first, so that the glory of the house of David and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem shall not become greater than that of Judah. In that day the Lord will defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and the one who is feeble among them in that day shall be like David, and the house of David shall be like God, like the angel of the Lord before them. And it shall be in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. And they'll have, obviously, supernatural help as well. In the book of Joel, this reference was too long to place in, but to place in a slide. So I just decided that we would read this together. Joel 3. For behold, in those days and at that time, when I bring back the captives of Judah and Jerusalem, I'll also gather all nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat, and I will enter into judgment with them there on account of my people, my heritage, Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations. They have also divided up my land, and they have cast lots for my people, have given a boy as payment for a harlot, and sold a girl for wine that they may drink. Indeed, what have you to do with me, O Tyre and Sidon and all the coasts of Philistia? Will you retaliate against me? But if you retaliate against me swiftly and speedily, I will return your retaliation upon your own head, because you've taken my silver and my gold and have carried into your temples my prized possessions, also the people of Judah and the people of Jerusalem you've sold to the Greeks, that you may remove them from their borders. Behold, I will raise them out of the place to which you have sold them, and will return your retaliation upon your own head. I will sell your sons and your daughters in the hands of the people of Judah, and will sell them to the Sabaeans, to a people far off, for the Lord has spoken. Proclaim this among the nations. Prepare for war. Wake up the mighty men. Let all the men of war draw near. Let them come up. Beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into shears. Let the weak say, I am strong. Assemble and come, all you nations, and gather together all around, because cause your mighty ones to go down there, O Lord. Let the nations be weakened and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat, for there I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations. Put in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come on down, for the winepress is full, the vats overflow, for their fullness is great. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision, for the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. The sun and the moon will grow dark, and the stars will diminish their brightness. The Lord also will roar from Zion. Zion is symbolic of the church of God. And utter his voice from Jerusalem. The heavens and the earth will shake, but the Lord will be a shelter for his people and the strength of the children of Israel. So you shall know that I am the Lord your God, dwelling in Zion, my holy mountain. Then Jerusalem shall be holy, and no alien shall ever pass through her again. And it will come to pass in that day that the mountains shall drip with new wine, the hills shall flow with milk, and all the brooks of Judah shall be flooded with water. A fountain shall flow from the house of the Lord in the valley of Acacias. Egypt shall be a desolation, and Edom a desolate wilderness, because of violence against the people of Judah. For they have shed innocent blood in their land, but Judah shall abide forever in Jerusalem from generation to generation. For I will acquit them of the guilt of bloodshed, whom I had not acquitted, for the Lord dwells in Zion. It's an astonishing prophecy of the future of Israel and a future of the church of God as well. And when all of that happens, we don't know. But we do know that some of the events that are happening now are a forerunner to end time prophecy. We don't give sermons on prophecy to scare people into obedience. We don't give sermons on prophecy to keep you spiritually alert. Well, maybe that adds a part of it. But we give sermons on prophecy because it's a full third of the Bible. It's not meant to scare anybody to death. It's simply meant to encourage you to be obedient to God, because we see what happens to the people who are not obedient to God, and we have been given an advance notice of all of these things, and we understand what is going to happen in the future, but that is not going to provide salvation. What is going to provide salvation is your closeness to God and your obedience to God and His commandments in your everyday life. So I hope that some of this has been a little bit helpful, fills in maybe a few gaps and maybe adds a few gaps that weren't there, and we can discuss it in the chat with the messenger.